This weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Vaccine logistics. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
With a COVID vaccine likely available to frontline workers next month, we'll explore the process of getting it from the labs to the loading docks to your arm.
The glove box in your car may soon have more available space. Ford is among the manufacturers getting rid of the traditional owner's manual.
With a COVID vaccine likely available to frontline workers next month, we'll explore the process of getting it from the labs to the loading docks to your arm.
And more Americans embrace silent meditation at home these days, but it's not always so silent at home.
Well, these retreats often last about a week. And when you go to a retreat center in the woods or in a mountaintop in the good old pre-pandemic days, you would give up your cell phone and be kind of protected from distractions. But if you're doing it at home, you might have your dog barging in and your kids asking you to heat up a pizza.
Leslie Brody at the Wall Street Journal on meditation retreats at home. This portion of the program is brought to you by United Healthcare. United Healthcare Medicare Advantage plans come with a lot to take advantage of. Visit AdvantageWow.com to learn more. Encouraged by promising results from major clinical trials of two coronavirus vaccines, and now three, public health officials are preparing for the daunting task ahead of delivering those shots to tens of millions of Americans. Lena Sun, health reporter at The Washington Post, says among other things, the vaccines need to be distributed across 50 states plus U.S. territories that have different demographics and shifting needs. Lena, what do we have?
It's really complicated, and I think people need to understand that it is going to be rolled out in phases, and each phase is likely to have a lot of hiccups. But, people need to just keep that in mind. And it is really complicated, and it is going to take a while. But I think it's going to get done.
All right. So you gave examples from a couple of different states in terms of what they're doing. What'd you find there?
Well, I think you just have to remember that the vaccines that we're dealing with, it's complicated because they have to be stored at different temperatures. They have different minimum orders, and each of them requires two doses, but at different intervals. So you just think about the, permutations there for a lot of things. So some states have bought these ultra cold freezers. The Pfizer vaccine has to be kept at minus 70 degrees Celsius, which is about deep winter in Antarctica. Yeah. The other vaccine doesn't have to be kept as cold. And then they have to get them to people. But the minimum order for the Pfizer vaccine is 975 doses. So that means you are going to be likely to get it if you work at a large hospital that has those freezers and has the capability to maybe vaccinate more than 900 people at one time. But in the smaller rural areas, the hospitals don't have those freezers. They may only have 20 docs and 20 nurses. I mean, the first priority group is likely to go to healthcare workers. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be hard to round up enough people. And the Pfizer vaccine, for example, has a very complicated protocol. It needs to stay frozen. And then once you open the container, you can only open it twice. It has to be recharged with dry ice. There are a lot of things that go into handling it. And so that limits how quickly they can get it to people. And we're not going to have that many doses initially.
So what happens if you can't meet that minimum order of the minimum of 975 doses? If you're a small hospital, say?
Well, I think a lot of states are trying to figure out a way to, let's say you're a big hospital system and the central hub is in a big city, but there's satellite hospitals or other clinics that are part of your system, then maybe you organize a clinic at that campus and people drive to you to get the shots, from other places.
Yeah.
But when it gets rolled out to a much broader group of Americans, pharmacies will be involved. There will be mass vaccination clinics also. And so in Maine, for example, they're thinking, how is the, what's the best way to vaccinate people in the dead of winter when it's freezing outside, right? You want people to be outside. So they're thinking about maybe using car washes, because car washes have an in and an out, and the vaccinator can stand inside where it's heated and just wear their protective stuff, not like all the parkas and gloves and stuff, and you can drive through, roll down your window, get the shot, drive out.
We're speaking with Lena Sun, health reporter on the national staff of the Washington Post. She's got a good story entitled, Now Comes the Hardest Part, Getting a Coronavirus Vaccine from Loading Dock to Upper Arm. All right, so you referenced these frontline healthcare workers in line to get the vaccine, also essential workers, which would include who? Because you said they come from a lot of the, like, the minority communities, right?
Well, I mean, essential workers, so here's how it works. The federal government is going to set a list of recommendations for who should get the vaccines first, because when they get finally authorized by the Food and Drug Administration, there's not going to be enough for everybody. So who should be the priority to get it first? A lot of people think that it will be healthcare workers on the front line. So these are not just doctors and nurses, but custodial folks, people who are in direct contact with patients, and then the other essential workers. You know, every state is going to have different essential workers, right? The snowplow driver in Minnesota will be essential, but maybe the mosquito catcher in Florida will be essential. So the federal government will sort of broadly define who are essential workers. And then each state will make the final decisions like, okay, we have this many healthcare workers, we have this many other workers, we're going to decide these people will come first. And the idea is they want the federal government, the federal committee that is going to be making these recommendations wants to keep equity in mind, and they're going to define essential workers in such a way that it will include communities of color where a lot of people have been harder hit. They cannot work remotely. Mm-hmm. They don't have public transportation, and they live in crowded housing, so it's much more likely that, you know, they would pass the virus on to family.
Well, you referenced having to coordinate, too, with the likes of UPS and FedEx. And given this time of year when there are lots of holiday packages to be delivered, what happens there?
Well, that's why it's a really complicated dance. Pfizer is working directly with UPS and FedEx to ship their vaccines in these special containers that keep it cold, minus 70. You know, these convoys will be moving. They will be shipping by FedEx and also by plane. That's Pfizer's vaccine. The other vaccines are going to be shipped through a central distributor, which has networks around the country. And that's all going to be moving, you know, in that network. I don't know exactly how this is all going to work, because they're doing this in sort of real time, and it's never been done before to vaccinate this many people in basically over the next several months.
Thanks, Lena. Lena Sun, health reporter at The Washington Post. Coming up next, the political turkeys of 2020. Dell Technologies just announced their Black Friday sale, releasing new doorbusters every weekday, plus up to 50% off cutting-edge tech for your business. There's no better time to upgrade your small business with the latest laptops and desktops with Intel Core processors. Plus, there's free shipping on everything. Give Dell Technologies advisors a call. They'll identify the right tech solution for your business. Call 877-ASK-DELL or go to dell.com/sbblackfriday. Thanks for spending part of your Thanksgiving weekend with us. In this crazy and tumultuous political year, the political turkeys have emerged. Josh Kraushaar, politics editor at National Journal, puts together his annual list. This year, he says it doesn't just rank not ready for primetime candidates, but also the institutions and strategies that did not live up to expectations. Josh, who's on it?
This is my annual list of the worst political performers in 2020. And I have a list of seven either individuals or strategies and tactics that failed in 2020. But top of the list were two Senate candidates. One, appointed Senator Martha McSally, who was one of the few Republican senators that ran behind Donald Trump in a state that was very, very competitive, and ultimately lost two Senate races in about 3 years. It's a hard feat to do, especially in a Republican-leaning state like Arizona. And the other was a Democrat, Kentucky Senate candidate, Amy McGrath, who spent almost $88 million of campaign cash, only to lose by almost 16 points to Mitch McConnell in one of the biggest blowouts on all the big Senate races.
Boy. But, I mean, not to get too deep into the weeds here, but what were the issues for both of those Senate candidates?
Well, look, I think the theme in these underperforming political performers is that money doesn't mean more than message. And Amy McGrath had a lot of money because she was running against Mitch McConnell, but it didn't substitute for having an effective, compelling message. She was a pretty poor candidate and didn't have an overarching argument other than voting out the Senate Majority Leader. In the case of McSally, she didn't know where she wanted to stand within the Republican Party. Mm. She needed to kind of appeal to a more moderate suburban voting base in Arizona, and which ended up tipping the state to Joe Biden. But she ended up being so close to the base, she alienated a lot of those moderate voters.
Another turkey on your list: the billionaire former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg. Why him?
Boy, I mean, he could be number one on the list. He spent about $1 billion of his own money in the presidential race, only to win delegates, only to win the Virgin Islands, and coming in first place there. 55 or 59 delegates total. An abysmal performance, but it wasn't just that, Gordon. He also spent over $100 million in three big battleground states for Joe Biden: Ohio, Texas, and also the state of Florida, which he was most invested in. Those were states that Trump won easily. In Florida, Trump actually did better in 2020 than he did in 2016. So to continue the theme, money really doesn't matter when it comes to politics.
And what happened? There was a little controversy with not wanting to pay health insurance for some of his staff that he ultimately laid off?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bloomberg said, he would help Democrats down ballot, and he would create this big, big machine, win or lose, with his personal money. Now, he did, in the very end, spend some money for Joe Biden, but he laid his whole staff off after losing on Super Tuesday, and it took a long time for him to be pressured into paying his staff health care in the middle or at the beginning of the pandemic. So, I mean, this is someone who was rich enough to spend $1 billion of his own money for a losing presidential campaign, but didn't want to fork over the health benefits to his campaign staff.
Wow. We're speaking with Josh Krauthaar, politics editor at National Journal. His piece is called The Biggest Political Turkeys of 2020. This is an annual list that he puts together. Number five on your list, too, you wrote about the progressive House challengers.
Yeah, I mean, there was more straight ticket, straight party voting than ever before in this election, but there were some races where Democratic candidates ran well behind Joe Biden, and these were the cases where Democrats nominated, Bernie Sanders supporting progressive challengers in big, big races. You've got Carrie Eastman was a big candidate that got a lot of money and attention in Nebraska. She lost badly in a district that Joe Biden won in suburban Omaha. Dana Balter at upstate New York. Remember Wendy Davis? She ran for governor of Texas. Mm-hmm. Was a sort of a liberal poster child for how Texas could start to become blue. Well, she ran against a very right-wing Republican congressman, and she got blown out in that battleground race. There are five races that were big, big targeted races for progressive candidates. The progressives went 0-for-5 and ran behind Joe Biden in all five of those races.
Wow. Finish up with number six on your list, the Republican recruiting holes in Trump districts.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans were just as stunned as anyone that the polling was a little bit off and that the House ended up, Republicans ended up gaining at least 10 seats in the House with a few seats still up in the air. That was, against all the expectations, including their own. What happened is that there were some races based on the results where Republicans barely spent any money and Democratic members of Congress barely won their elections. And with a little bit of money, with a little bit of attention, they probably could have won a handful more seats, maybe even taken back the majority. But because the polling was so off, because the money wasn't there, Republicans ended up just coming a little bit short.
Thanks, Josh. Josh Krauthaar, politics editor at National Journal. Coming up next, more Americans dabble in silent retreats. Black Friday's on the way, as you know, and let's be honest, things have gotten a little crazy. If you're looking for great clothes as gifts or for yourself, you can't beat cutsclothing.com. Cuts makes the best t-shirts, polos, and hoodies you can find, combining classic looks with modern fabrics. And when they say modern, we're talking up-to-the-minute technology. The new Pika Pro fabric is downright buttery soft. You got to wear it to believe it. It's an amazing combination of fit, fabric, and function. Perfect for work, a night out, or anything in between. Skip the gimmicks. Pick up the quality, minimalist clothes that your favorite athletes, entrepreneurs, and even podcast hosts are upgrading to. For example, I wear a Cuts t-shirt under an open flannel shirt. with a sports jacket and just as a t-shirt. Shop CutsClothing.com between November 11 and December 1st to save 30% site-wide. That's 30% off everything with no code required. CutsClothing.com between November 11 and December 1. Cuts Clothing, the only t-shirt worth wearing. CutsClothing.com.
Well, more Americans are finding relief from the stress of the coronavirus by attending or embarking on a week-long silent retreat. How it works from this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
When we're all stuck at home, how do we get away from it all? As Leslie Brody of the Wall Street Journal tells us, some are trying to find quiet refuge by staying in place, but it's not easy. Leslie, what are some of the obstacles people are facing with silent meditation at home?
Well, these retreats often last about a week. And when you go to a retreat center in the woods or in a mountaintop in the good old pre-pandemic days, you would give up your cell phone and be kind of protected from the distractions. But if you're doing it at home, you might have your dog barging in or your kids asking you to heat up a pizza or, your spouse trying to talk to you. It's much harder to give up the sort of comforts when they're all around you. I mean, no alcohol, no sex, no Netflix, no reading a book is discouraged because it keeps you away from your inward journey. You know, if you're going to take it really seriously, it's a tall order to do at home.
Leslie, how did you find the people that you talked to in your piece?
Actually, it all started with a friend of my daughter's who was doing it. He's 26 and I heard about it from him and thought it was pretty interesting. But then when I talked to some of the leaders of these retreats, they introduced me to some students who introduced me to some students. And also I found a few who had tweeted about it. I guess they had returned to technology if they were on Twitter. But, you word of mouth, you find one connects you to another.
Leslie, what are some of the benefits of not talking and separating yourself from what's going on in the world?
Well, I think especially right now, the pace of news is so fast and so much of it is upsetting. All the virus news and the elections are very divisive. The people who are doing these retreats told me they just needed a break. They needed, just a refuge from the constant chatter and noise in the news world and the political world. And people who met, many of them have meditated for years and they just wanted a deeper version of that. And they find that, if you pause and are quiet and you can go deeper inside yourself, emotions emerge that you can process that can't if you're busy doing a million things. They talk about the sacred art of pausing and, say that you can deepen your attention to the present moment if you're not talking.
We're speaking with Leslie Brody of the Wall Street Journal. Leslie, from everything I've read and experienced and discussed with people, meditation really takes practice. When you sit down and try to shut things out, usually your mind is going a million miles an hour, and it's kind of the opposite. What did you find with the people you talked to?
Well, many of them talk about it as a practice, meaning it's something you have to really try to do in a concentrated way. And I think they rely on each other for support. They do these trainings with leaders who help them, guide them through their meditations and help them acknowledge thoughts as they come up and then let them go. Now there are a lot of apps that are sort of guided meditation apps that are supposedly helpful. I have never been good at meditating. I wish I could learn the skill. Maybe I'll try again soon. But it's not easy.
You talk about the apps. Your story also talked about some virtual silent retreats. How can a computer or some kind of an organized thing online help you?
Well, I think that most of the ones I was talking about were virtual retreats. They would have a teacher who would, talk about the lesson of the day and lead yoga classes. And with some of these online retreats, once a day you could ask questions as a participant. You were allowed to speak then to talk about, how to focus better or
how to deal with difficult feelings that were popping up. I think that, you would see all these other meditators in these, Zoom squares on your laptop. And, for some people, they felt a sense of connection even over the internet with the other people doing it at the same time.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Leslie Brody. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Today, I'm here with Josh Hunt, Executive Vice President and Chief Business Development Officer at the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Josh, what were the biggest challenges for MEDC from the pandemic?
Michigan was one of the hardest hit states by COVID-19. At the MEDC, what we did is we immediately began focusing on economic response measures from COVID-19 to support our businesses, our communities, and our workforce in every region of the state. The first closures of businesses here in Michigan as a result of the pandemic happened on March 16th, and it was on March 19th that we launched our first financial tool to help small businesses that were impacted. And so it was an immediate and ongoing response where we leveraged every resource available to help mitigate the negative impacts of COVID-19.
Thanks, Josh. To hear more of this interview with Josh Hunt from MEDC, go to thismorningwithgordondeal.com and click on the MEDC microphone. Thanks for spending part of your Thanksgiving weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, a key to healthier adult diets. Also, the bad financial influences in your immediate surroundings. Plus, what could be the end of the car owner's manual, and the Utah woman who was led to a good deed by paying attention to her doorbell camera. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, new research suggests that feeding babies the right healthy foods during a critical window of time may help set them up for better health as adults. As the federal government weighs the first ever dietary guidelines for children under two, there's evidence that the food habits of young kids influence their diet and their health later on. More from Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Andrea, take us through this.
So there's emerging research that showing that feeding babies the right healthy foods during a critical window of time, actually it looks like between 6 and 12 months, may help set them up for a better diet later on and better health later on. And this is coming at a time when the federal government is actually considering the first ever dietary guidelines for children under two. And there's many, so that is putting a lot of, putting a spotlight on the diets of babies and toddlers, as well as a pretty alarming rise in the incidence of childhood obesity, as well as a growing understanding that the seeds of adult illnesses like type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease are really planted in childhood. And so there's a lot more interest in how to mold the palates of the youngest among us.
It seems to be logical that if you have your baby eating healthy foods, that they would continue to eat healthy foods, I'd presume. What are they going to do about this, or how's that information going to be pushed out?
Right. So what it looks like, this research is really showing that there's, this window of time that looks like between about 6 to 12 months where babies are just kind of more receptive to flavors, including bitter flavors. Now, babies are actually primed to like sweet tastes. There's been a lot of really interesting research showing that even, shortly after birth, babies are much more, they actually kind of relax when they have sugar water in their mouth versus other flavors. This makes sense because, as one researcher told me, sweet is a indicator of calories, and that's what growing children need is calories. Also, breast milk is sweet, so it makes a lot of evolutionary sense of why babies would be primed to want something sweet. But obviously, our environment has changed dramatically, and there's added sugar everywhere. Yeah. And, now it's not so, babies and young children are very vulnerable to foods with added sugars. And there's a lot of researchers believe that, having added sugars at a very young age will sort of prime children to you know, continue to want them, because, mm-hmm. you know, children are learning what things are supposed to taste like, what yogurt is supposed to taste like, what, you know, all sorts of foods. And so if they have things loaded with sugar, that's what they're going to believe that it's supposed, that, you know, the food is supposed to taste like. Yeah. And so they're going to continue to reach for that.
We're speaking with Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her piece is called "The Key to Healthier Adult Diets, Healthier Baby Diets." It struck me, too, that that 6-month-old to 12-month-old window might be before toddlers are able to exert the power of no, right? Because that's the kind of the one thing that they can control.
Right, exactly. Right. I mean, yeah, obviously, as anyone who's had children or been around children knows, I mean, you know, the terrible twos are called that for a reason, that that is often when kids have a lot more agency. So they have a lot more say in what they do. And so by really capitalizing on that early window when they're much more, you know, easygoing or amenable to parental influence, you know, you can really take the opportunity to introduce your baby to a lot of different foods, and particularly different healthy foods, so that they are more likely to continue to eat them.
Thanks, Andrea. Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Do you tend to do what your friends and neighbors do when it comes to money? You may not even know it, but keep an eye out. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com, says they could be the reason you're poor and unhappy. Jonathan, explain.
So what a lot of research has found is that we tend to be influenced in our views by the people we know, by our neighbors, by family, by friends. I mean, we all like to think that we're independent thinkers and reach our own judgments, but it's simply not the case. And one thing that has been discovered in the research is that how we invest tends to be influenced by who our neighbors are. If our neighbors are buying a particular stock, what the research has found is that we're more likely to be buying that stock. Presumably all this happens because, you know, people are talking over the garden fence, you know, they're, you know, meeting at neighborhood parties, whatever it is people do in the time of coronavirus. But the net result is the research has found that if people in one zip code are buying a particular stock, people in the same zip code tend to be buying that same company, and it's presumably because they're communicating with one another.
Wow. Is that harmful?
It depends. If your neighbor is some wild day trader who's in and out of Tesla and, you know, goodness knows what else, yeah, it could hurt you if you become a day trader yourself. On the other hand, if your neighbor is a nice, calm, sedate, prudent investor in total market index funds and you become the same sort of investor, that could work to your benefit.
Yeah. All right, so that's the kind of investing front. What about on the spending front?
We always know that people tend to keep up with the Joneses. So if the neighbors are living a high, you know, living lifestyle, we're going to tend to replicate that. We know that's the case. But what the research has found is that not only do people tend to imitate their neighbors, but they imitate them to the point where they can get themselves in financial trouble. There's a famous study done a couple of years ago of the neighbors of Canadian lottery winners. If somebody in the town wins the lottery, what they found is that their neighbors are likely to end up going bankrupt.
Jeez.
So people imitate their neighbors who have won the lottery to the degree that they overspend so much and take on so much debt that they end up in the bankruptcy court. What the research has also found is that not only do people spend more and obviously take on more debt, but they even start investing more aggressively, presumably with the goal of financing their expensive lifestyle that they've now adopted. There was another study in the Netherlands which also looked at the neighbors of lottery ticket winners, and what they found was that in the period after the lottery was won by one of their neighbors, the people in the area tended to buy new cars. And you say, well, why would they be buying new cars? And the researchers conclude that what these people are doing is buying that new car to show off to their neighbors that they, you know, they too are financially successful. So if you just go on a ritzy vacation or you just throw a lavish one-time party, that happens and it's gone, and it's not there to remind your neighbors that you're financially successful. But if you go and you buy a new car, it's sitting there in the driveway every day telling your neighbors, hey, I'm also a financial success. I also have plenty of money, even if you don't.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Dell Technologies just announced their Black Friday sale, releasing new doorbusters every weekday, plus up to 50% off cutting-edge tech for your business. There's no better time to upgrade your small business with the latest laptops and desktops with Intel Core processors. Plus, there's free shipping on everything. Give Dell Technologies advisors a call. They'll identify the right tech solution for your business. Call 877-ASK-DELL or go to dell.com/SBBlackFriday.
This year, Michigan businesses have had to adapt, and the Michigan Economic Development Corporation was right there alongside them, helping to connect businesses to new resources, meet new partners, and access the additional capital they needed right from the start. If your business needs support to reach its new potential, the MEDC is available to help in any way we can. Contact us today for customized business assistance at michiganbusiness.org/partnership.
This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. Online videos are the new owner's manual for many car owners. What does the check engine light mean? Google it. How do you change the clock? Find a video on YouTube. Or, as a growing number of automakers would like you to do, look it up using the touchscreen on your vehicle's center console. Nathan Bomey, business reporter at USA Today, says that's precisely what Ford is hoping customers will do. Nathan, what's up here?
Well, anytime Ford changes something with the F-150, I take it pretty seriously. I mean, this is obviously the most popular vehicle in America, and Ford is reducing the size of the owner's manual from 704 pages in the Ford F-150 to 150 or so pages. So a drastic reduction. Essentially, they're taking out everything that isn't absolutely necessary to operate the vehicle in the event of some sort of significant incident. For example, if you lose power to the vehicle and need to know what to do next. So this is a really big step toward digital owner's manuals.
Which leads me to ask you, how does a 700-page owner's manual fit in the glove compartment?
Well, it seems like too much information is no information in a way, and Ford having gotten up to 700 plus pages on the F-150 manual, it feels like you'd never be able to find something in there. It's like War and Peace sitting in your glove box, but they're going to save like 290 tons of paper by doing this. Just shows you how popular that car is.
And that equates to a number of F-150s, correct?
Right. It's pretty wild. I mean, the F-150 sells tens of thousands of vehicles every month. So this is making a big impact, but they're also going to do this with the Mach-E, the new Mustang electric crossover that Ford is doing, and then also future Ford. So I think this is going to be a trend that we're going to see in a lot of other vehicles.
We're speaking with Nathan Bomey, business correspondent at USA Today. His piece is called, Is the Car Owner's Manual History? 2021 Ford F-150 ditches traditional paper copy. So is all the info or some of the info going to be loaded on these touchscreens?
Exactly. So essentially, they're going to transition much of the manual to how-to videos, for example. So you'll be able to touch the screen on your Mach-E or your F-150 or future Fords, and you'll be able to then see a video on how to, for example, change the oil or something like that. And they'll also incorporate a physical or a digital copy of the physical manual in there too, so you can actually page through it if you want. But the only paper copy will be this reduced version that'll have information on what to do if you've lost vehicle power or you don't have an internet connection.
So how do you use the touchscreen if the battery dies?
Yeah, well, it is a problem, and some of the experts I talked to are concerned about that. Ultimately, being able to reach for the physical manual is pretty reliable. It's there, and it might take you a while to page through it, but you'll find what you need eventually. And I think the view, though, is that vehicles are really much more reliable these days than ever before. The chances that you buy a 2021 F-150 and it completely dies on you and you lose power are pretty low. And ultimately, even if you do, your phone will probably be in have power. And a lot of people just tap on their phone now and look for something on YouTube on how to fix their vehicle. So that's also a solution for most folks.
And this is something Tesla is already doing?
Yeah, exactly. They've gone completely digital with their owner's manual, so they don't even provide a paper copy of any kind. You know, pretty typical for Tesla to be on the cutting edge of where this trend is happening. Other automakers have also put in to their vehicles various digital versions, but none have actually reduced the size of the manual until now. So this is definitely a first from Ford.
Thanks, Nathan. Nathan Bomey, business reporter at USA Today. Coming up next, when your Ring doorbell is used for charitable purposes. Well, we'll finish with this. A woman in Utah became a Good Samaritan by financially helping out her delivery man to get back on his feet. Captured on video, Jennifer Weiss saw Larry, who was only identified by his first name, stumble up to her door while delivering groceries. Ms. Weiss told ABC4 News that the situation made her look within. Larry, who's a veteran, took the job because he says he needed to pay for home repairs. Larry, who's from Ogden, Utah, had a stroke back in June, says he was making some extra money because the swamp cooler blew off the roof of his home, leaving a big hole. Ms. Weiss found Larry online and offered to help, asking friends to pitch in to give him a big tip. She posted his Venmo information, and the donations started pouring in. Larry says it blew up like crazy, and he's stunned with the number of nice people who responded. Ms. Weiss says you just never know when a small donation could cause a snowball effect, even with just small dollar amounts. She posted the video from her doorbell camera on social media and was able to raise enough money to help Larry pay for his roof repairs. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.